Да здравствует 60-я годовщина Великой Октябрьской социалистической революции! Да здравствует героический советский народ и его доблестные вооруженные силы! Слава Коммунистической партии Советского Союза, руководящей и направляющей силе советского общества! Ура!
Listening to Back in the USSR on 93.3 FM CFRU, I am Siegfried, and this week we're going to continue discussing the broader context of the war in Ukraine. You may recall that in my last episode I described it as the elephant in the room that no one could avoid, and how Western media has gone into absolute overdrive hyping up this European war affecting people who quote-unquote look like you and me. You know, and I went through a bunch of examples last time about, you know, the various outlets and stuff through explicitly saying this, you know, explicitly describing it in these terms, in these very racialized terms, you know, and there's no getting around it because the media and politicians have made it all consuming. You know, they've made coverage of this war all consuming, in complete contrast with the wars in Yemen, Mali, Afghanistan, Congo, Syria, Libya, Iraq, Somalia, Colombia, and the list goes on. These wars, which mainly affect non-white people, are considered normal. And violence in those countries is taken for granted by media consumers in Canada and other Western countries in the imperial core. Obviously, people actually living in those war-torn lands would beg to differ. And the same is true for the people, the violence waged by the Ukrainian government against the people of the Donbass in eastern Ukraine since the U.S.-backed coup in 2014, which I talked about last week. You know, the violent coup, which overthrew a democratically elected government and brought this far-right regime into power in Kiev, right? Which the media doesn't like to talk about and what it does. I mean, 14,000 people, mainly civilians, died in eastern Ukraine prior to the current Russian intervention, according to UN figures. You know, that's 14,000 people over about, 7 years. And yet the Western media and Ukrainian Canadians didn't say a word. All that time, didn't say a word as all those people died. Just like they prefer not to talk about Ukrainian neo-Nazis getting guns and training from Western governments for years now, right? And now there's all these far-right fascists basically pouring into Ukraine, these volunteers who want to fight the Russians, this sort of thing, and it's just becoming an El Dorado for the far-right. And they're going to get guns, they're going to get training, they're going to be able to go back to their countries of origin, and who knows what they're going to be able to do there, right? All these battle-hardened neo-Nazis, fascists, far-right militants. But all this gets to the heart of the sheer hypocrisy that is everywhere these days and which is driving me absolutely crazy. I mean, I checked out both of the Stand With Ukraine rallies held at Guelph City Hall, held at Guelph City Hall in the last 2 weeks. And for all their talk of peace, there was nothing anti-war about them. Nothing anti-war about either one of them. I mean, basically, in both instances, you had a bunch of angry white people, most of whom have probably never attended a protest or demo in their lives, and would certainly never show up in solidarity with Indigenous land defenders, Palestinians, or Black Lives Matter activists. You know, you have all these angry white people showing up and parroting the talking points of the mainstream media, you know, and doing a lot of macho support our troops, nationalist posturing with regard to Ukraine, and calling for the devastating sanctions and collective punishment of Russian civilians to be expanded even further. And, I mean, the one this past Saturday was attended by the mayor and our local MP, and, and both of them gave the usual BS about Ukraine being a peaceful and democratic country that was suddenly set upon by this monster called Putin because he woke up on the wrong side of the bed one day or something. You know, there was zero analysis, zero context, pure propaganda. But these people were eating it up. I mean, these demos can hardly be considered protests in any real sense. I mean, they're officially sanctioned outlets for white solidarity and white rage against an officially approved adversary. An officially approved adversary. In short, these demonstrators are doing what they've been told by the government and media. There's no autonomy here. You know, they're certainly not defying any authority in this country and can hardly be considered brave or defiant or anything like that. And the lack of a police presence was also notable at these demos. Quote unquote, demos. I mean, Canada, as a settler colonial state based on genocide, hasn't got a leg to stand on when it comes to criticizing Russia. And yet, Lloyd Longfield and Cam Guthrie were talking like it's an untarnished, shimmering beacon of freedom and democracy. And I think the folks at 1492 Landback Lane, you know, defending their lands against the OPP and developers and stuff, they might have a thing or two to say about that. You know, down at Six Nations. I mean, let alone the Wet'suwet'en or the folks from dozens of First Nations across the country who are in the process of digging up the bodies of their children from the sites of former residential schools. You know, is that freedom and democracy? You know, it's a scary situation we're living through. Everything Russian is being demonized and censored, you know, to truly ridiculous degrees. I mean, the University of Milan, there was a lot of talk on Twitter about this, just this past week. The University of Milan in Italy even canceled a course on Dostoevsky, the great Russian author, citing the conflict as justification, before an online backlash forced them to renew it, you know, and you know, because there was all this like coming in at every certain, like this is ridiculous. You're banning a course on this Russian author who's been dead for more than 100 years, you know, very famous author, all kinds of like amazing literature. You're banning that because of the current conflict in Ukraine. I mean, that's crazy. And fortunately, they backed off on that. But, you know, you have the LCBO pouring out Russian vodka, getting rid of it, you know, this sort of thing, supposedly in solidarity with Ukraine. Russian media is being banned on every social media platform, and practically every means of economic warfare in the book is being piled on the Russian people, from banking and credit card shutdowns to suspensions from international sporting events, you know. And all of this happened practically overnight. Practically overnight, you know, it's like almost snapping their fingers, you know. Officials made this happen in the West. And I can understand the frustrations of Palestinian activists when they see this. You know, they've been pushing for boycott, divestment, and sanctions against apartheid Israel for years, only to be censured and even criminalized at every turn. You know, how many states in the U.S. now have, like, you know, actual laws banning BDS campaigns as anti-Semitic? You know, and all this because, you know, they were pushing for punitive actions against a government that targets and oppresses non-white people, right? I mean, Israel targets and oppresses non-white people, and it's considered normal. You know, the West really doesn't have a problem with it. You know, so once again, major double standards, but it's easy to understand them if you know how imperialism works. And of course, I've talked a lot about imperialism on this show over the years, but it's worth expanding on here because there's a lot of confusion. I mean, Israel is an extension of the U.S. empire. When it oppresses Palestinians or bombs people in Syria and Lebanon, which it does all the time, that's not Israeli imperialism. That's U.S. imperialism. That's not Israel acting alone. You know, it's acting as an extension of the empire. It's acting as, you know, the closest American ally in the region, you know, that relies upon American military aid and economic aid and all this sort of thing. It's an extension of the U.S. It's U.S. imperialism. Saudi Arabia is an extension of the U.S. empire. When it bombs Yemen, it's not Saudi imperialism. It's U.S. imperialism. You know, Saudi Arabia is it's a client kingdom of the U.S. It's totally dependent on the U.S., you know, for weapons, for exports, for everything. And its foreign policy is basically in lockstep with the U.S. Same with Israel. And same with many countries around the world. Even when they don't come out and say it, the actions of these countries fundamentally serve American interests. And ever since the coup in 2014, Ukraine has been an extension of the U.S. empire. You know, all its, you know, economic policy, foreign policy, everything has been in lockstep with what the U.S. wants. And this is the main reason why the Minsk Accords, which I talked about last week, you know, that peace deal, which was supposed to end the fighting in eastern Ukraine and bring peace to the country. That was, you know, the fact that Ukraine basically is dominated by the U.S., that's the main reason why the Minsk Accords failed. And why other peace negotiations since then have failed. Because the U.S. wanted them to fail. They wanted the conflict to continue. That served American interests. Peace did not serve American interests. The U.S. wants to use Ukraine and the Ukrainian people as a bludgeon against Russia. They want Ukraine and Russia to fight one another. Because it serves American interests. It serves American interests in unifying NATO against a common enemy. You know, and it serves American interests by blocking Chinese and Russian economic cooperation with the EU, which is becoming huge in recent years, and the U.S. didn't like it. It serves American interests by ensuring a market for U.S. fracked natural gas in Europe at the expense of cheaper Russian natural gas, which the EU has been relying on, and also by providing a major market for the U.S. arms industry. You know, the U.S. has pumped billions and billions of dollars worth of arms into Ukraine, like, since 2014. And it's pumping even more in, like, now that the war is happening. They're not pushing for peace negotiations. They're pushing for more guns to be sent. And for more tensions and for more war and more violence. You know, you don't see the U.S. pushing for peace negotiations. You know, and of course the U.S. wants to potentially destabilize a major adversary through sanctions and other means. You know, they want to destabilize Russia. They want to put as many sanctions on Russia as they can. They want to undermine it in any way they can. And they're using Ukraine to do that as well. all without a single American soldier dying in combat. And this is the real game being played here. The U.S. wants the biggest bang for its buck. It wants to, you know, stir the pot, you know, stir tensions, you know, get the actors on the ground to do what it wants. And at a minimum expense, minimum of cost. You know. So, and here's a major thing that that's really been grinding my gears recently. Brothers and sisters, there is no such thing as Russian imperialism in the 21st century. You could say back in the 19th century, yes, there was, you know, with Russian occupying, say, Poland and like these other oppressed peoples, you know, before the revolution of 1917, you know, broke that down and like, you know, reconstituted Russia on a new socialist order, which actually gave liberation to the people who were oppressed under the Tsarist regime, the Tsarist government. But there is no Russian imperialism today. Imperialism is not a byword, and this is huge. Imperialism is not a byword for one country invading or taking military action against another. That in itself is not imperialism. Imperialism is, as Lenin said, the highest form of capitalism, the highest stage of capitalism. And it's a combination of military, political, economic, and even in cultural factors. Because capitalism is a system. It's a complete system. An imperial power doesn't just conquer territory. It also conquers markets. And it seizes economic control of entire societies in order to serve its own interests. And this is what the US and Western corporations do around the world under the auspices of the IMF and the World Bank, which have effectively colonized the economy of Ukraine since 2014, you know, privatizing the land, the labor, the resources, as they've done in countries throughout the global south, you know, all around the world. Countries dominated in this manner are not independent. They cannot independently set monetary policy, regulate the economy, or control finance. They are subject to the dictates of international capital as upheld by the American Empire, as enforced by the American Empire. Countries that defy this global order, like Iraq, Venezuela, or Syria, can expect sanctions, sabotage, and military action. We've seen this again and again. And this is not what Russia is doing in Ukraine. Russia does not economically dominate Ukraine. And given that Russia's economy is frankly on par with some of the smallest countries in the Eurozone, like Portugal, small economy, even though like Russia is the biggest country in terms of landmass in the world, it is economically, it is small. It is small. It is not an economic powerhouse by any means. And frankly, lacks the capacity to control or exploit foreign markets. Russian capitalists simply do not have the power to do that. I mean, the Russian economy is overwhelmingly dependent upon the export of raw materials from oil to titanium. And it produces very few finished products. I think one of the few finished products it produces is fertilizer. I mean, that's one of the reasons why fertilizers, you know, the cost of fertilizer is exploding around the world right now because of this war. I mean, the basis of an imperialist economy is the import of cheap resources from the global south and the export of finished products to countries in the global south. This is what the U.S. has been doing for a very long time. You know, they'll suck in all these cheap resources from all over the world. You know, from these countries, which basically their entire economy is based on producing these resources. And then they will export, you know, high technology products, you know, finished products, all this stuff, you know, manufactured goods, that sort of thing, that will be exported back to those places in the global south. And obviously massive profits are made in this way. This is what the West does, you know, keeping the global south in a position of subservience and exploitation. Russia, on the other hand, might be described as a third world country with nuclear missiles, right? I mean, back when it was the USSR, that was not the case. You know, it was a very highly industrialized society, you know, where, you know, it was one of the biggest economies in the world. But that all changed, you know, with the collapse of the USSR and the, you know, the biggest economic crisis in peacetime anywhere in the world, which happened in Russia in the 1990s, where, like, you know, life expectancy fell by more than 10 years. You know, you had a complete collapse of the economy. Just complete destruction of people's lives and livelihoods, complete destruction of like any social safety net. You know, that destroyed that and basically reduced Russia to third world status, where it basically still is. I mean, things have actually gotten better there since the 90s, but I mean, nonetheless, they've never really been able to come back and restore manufacturing to where it was or any of that kind of thing. It basically is a country dependent upon resource exports, right? Just like, you know, so many countries in say Africa or South America are dependent upon resource exports, you know, to the West. And they're kind of kept in a subordinate position because of that. You know, there's been a lot of stupid comparisons between the Russian intervention in Ukraine and the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003. Just absolutely stupid. You know, with attempts to being made to equate the two. This despite the fact that Iraq was on the other side of the planet from the United States. It was in the Middle East. On the other side of the planet. And it presented no credible threat to the United States. You know, that's why the U.S. had to conjure all this crazy stuff about, like, WMDs and, like, you know, all this, you know, crazy cartoonish reasons for going to war and all this sort of stuff. You know, and Iraq was ultimately targeted because it stood outside of the American-dominated global order and refused to follow the free market dictates of the IMF. And it was because of its economic and political independence from global capitalism, it was targeted for destruction by the U.S. empire in a very much imperialist war. Just as Libya and Syria would later be targeted in 2011. Ukraine, on the other hand, is directly on Russia's border. Its membership in NATO and the potential deployment of nuclear weapons on Ukrainian soil, which was absolutely on the table. That's something Vladimir Zelensky talked about just prior to the Russian intervention. At the end of February, he was talking to NATO. He wanted in NATO. He said he was going to rip up the treaty, which, you know, forbade nuclear weapons or nuclear material of nuclear weapons being stationed on Ukrainian soil. He was going to rip that up. And this does present a credible threat to Russian security. Ukraine was not targeted because it stands outside Russia's economic orbit, which is frankly very small and globally insignificant. But because the U.S. empire has been aggressively expanding in Eastern Europe since the end of the Cold War, you know, ultimately putting NATO troops directly on Russia's western frontier. It's notable that Russian gas exports to Europe via the Soviet-era pipelines through Ukraine has gone completely unmolested in this conflict. The gas has never been shut off. This is not a 1914 situation where, you know, you have rival great powers competing to divide up the world and become the new hegemon. The U.S. is the global hegemon in 2022 and the sole imperialist power in the world, to such an extent that Russia is compelled to continue supplying Europe with natural gas in the midst of a war zone. You know, a supply Ukraine can't interfere with either. I mean, Russia's goal in the conflict is to keep Ukraine out of NATO and ensure security on its borders. I haven't seen anything to contradict that in terms of what's happened in the last few weeks. You know, it's not bent on carving out a new export market to exploit or destroy an independent economy that the Fortune 500 views as a lost business opportunity, which is what America does and does regularly around the world. Every time it intervenes, that's basically what is at the root of the reason for its intervention. You know, America is imperialist, Russia is not. Russia is, you could say, a great power that intervenes to protect its security. And then you have America with its 800 plus military bases worldwide. You know, it's the guarantor of an entire global capitalist world order and uses imperial violence to keep so-called rogue states in line. You know, and ultimately keep down any threat to the imperatives of the global capitalist order. That's its goal. That's why it engages in violence, to prop up this system. Meanwhile, all Russia can do is intervene militarily in neighboring countries from time to time in order to deal with a real or perceived security threat, which is just what it like, just like what it did in Georgia with a very limited military intervention in 2008. I mean, America and Russia are very different countries, and the wars they fight are very different too. And this really needs to be kept in mind. This is crucial to understanding what is going on right now. If you don't understand that, you're going to get misled. You're going to be led astray by the media. And you're going to be making false comparisons that make no sense. and, you know, the next day you could be like, you know, effectively siding with neo-Nazis in Ukraine because you think they're freedom fighters against Russian imperialism or something. You know, I don't want people doing that. I don't want to see people doing that, let alone like some of my leftist friends. I don't want to see them do like being misled like that. So it's very important to understand imperialism, what that is. Understand that it's a system. It's not simply one country intervening in another country with its military. So building on that, I want to cut to a clip from Danny Haifong of The Left Lens. You know, once again, please follow The Left Lens and Danny Haifong on YouTube. You know, he's got excellent analysis of the Ukraine conflict and also the deep racism that it's revealed. But first, I want to play this short clip from People's Dispatch detailing the persecution of left-wing forces by the far-right Ukrainian government. And I want to express my solidarity with Mikhail and Alexander Kononovich of the Leninist Communist Youth Union of Ukraine, who were detained by Ukrainian authorities on March 6th and have experienced torture and are facing the very real threat of execution. They must be freed. These heroes who are fighting for a livable future for all Ukrainians, you know, outside of NATO, outside of the global capitalist order, you know, who want a future for their country, they must be freed. They must be free to continue to fight for liberation. That's the real liberation that needs to be fought for in Ukraine. You know, what these leftist forces, you know, Borotba, the Communist Party of Ukraine, all these forces which have been attacked, banned, driven underground, you know, over the last 8 years, since 2014, they are the future of Ukraine. You know, they are the ones who are fighting for a livable future. They're not, they understand who the real enemy is. They understand that the West is using Ukraine as cannon fodder against Russia. And they actually want a independent socialist republic. That's what they're fighting for. And they're the real heroes in this conflict. Just they've been the real heroes for years now. And I stand in solidarity with them. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
On March 6th, Ukrainian security forces arrested Mikhail and Alexander Kononovich. The brothers are leaders of the Leninist Communist Youth Union of Ukraine, or LKSMU. The Security Service of Ukraine later released a statement that the men had been detained in Kiev and then jailed. The Kononovich brothers were accused of being propagandists with pro-Russian and pro-Belarusian views. They allegedly had the goal of destabilizing the internal situation in Ukraine and creating the necessary information picture for Russian and Belarusian channels. The World Federation of Democratic Youth warned that the brothers' lives are in serious danger in custody. It urged progressive groups around the world to mobilize to demand their freedom. The LKSMU has been repeatedly targeted by Ukrainian government forces and ultra-nationalist neo-Nazi groups. This is part of a broader trend of the persecution of organizations with leftist and anti-European Union politics in Ukraine since the years back to the Euromaidan coup in February 2014. The period following the overthrow of the Viktor Yanukovych-led government was marked by severe violence against those who opposed the coup. One of the worst incidents was the massacre in Odessa in May, when a far-right fascist militia set fire to the House of Trade Unions in the southern city, killing at least 41 people who were trapped inside. In 2015, Ukraine passed decommunization laws which banned the use and display of communist symbols. This later led to the Communist Party of Ukraine being barred from contesting the 2019 elections. The leaders of the LKSMU, including the Kononovich brothers, who were active in the anti-fascist committee of Ukraine, were also brutally assaulted by neo-Nazis from the C14 and National Corpus groups in February 2018. Just weeks before their arrest, the Kononovich brothers had participated in a protest outside the U.S. embassy in Kiev, demanding that the US get out of Ukraine and stop its imperialist expansionism. LKSMU had recently also organized a campaign called Komsomol for Peace, calling for Ukraine to sever its ties with NATO and for a peaceful resolution with Russia. Communists in Ukraine have time and again protested the role of the US in the 2014 coup and in propping up right-wing and neo-Nazi groups. This included the financing, recruitment, and training of mercenaries from among Ukrainian Nazis, which they have called a project of the State Department and the CIA. Communists have also criticized the government for destroying the labor code, abolishing benefits like pensions and disability benefits, and selling land to foreigners. Shortly after pro-EU government was installed in the Ukraine in 2014, the country received a $17 billion loan from the IMF and an additional $3.5 billion package from the World Bank. These aid packages were heavily contingent on austerity measures, reportedly including agricultural deregulation and changes to land and natural resource policies, paving the way for foreign corporations to acquire massive tracts of land.
Far-right politics are very much a part of the Ukraine government as it's currently constituted, this coup government, this puppet government. So stories have emerged over the last 48 hours, of Ukraine's treatment, the military's treatment of Africans, people of Indian descent, Indian nationals, as they try to flee the country. There's actually a Ukrainian-only policy in terms of getting out of the country, because it's not a huge number comparatively, but I think there are reports saying there are about 150,000, 160,000 people trying to leave. They don't want to be in the area. Don't know where they're leaving to, but they're trying to leave the area where the fighting is happening. So I want to share the story, a video, just a minute long, of what's happening to African residents in Ukraine as they try to leave. So these are residents of Ukraine from South Africa, and they're being treated this way.
We're at the border of Medyka in Poland. This is the separation that has been happening, whereas Ukrainians are treated better while the Africans aren't. We've been pushed, we've been shoved. We are denied access, and there are so many of us compared to the Ukrainians. Ukrainians get special treatment while the Africans are waiting outside in the cold in big herds. You get people from Congo all around here, a lot of Africans. You get Africans from Rwanda here. It's just a mess at the moment.
So there you have it. That's one example. And actually, Business Insider did an article that I'm going to share here quickly about this as well. Sometimes Business Insider will do some okay reporting. I actually appreciate them using my statement as is. So here we go. African students fleeing the Russian invasion. I wouldn't use those terms, but the operation. Say they have predicted they have been prevented from crossing to Poland due to Ukrainians' first policy. Thousands of African students in Ukraine found themselves trapped following Russia's intervention. Some have said they've been discriminated against as they try to flee. They say they've been prevented from crossing the border as Ukrainian authorities prioritize Ukrainian people. So that's the reports that are coming out, that thousands of African students live in Ukraine to study medicine and other fields at more affordable prices. And a student in Ukraine, Corinne Sky, who helped coordinate escape routes for hundreds of African students trapped in the country, told Insider that some have struggled to get on buses heading to the border. Some people have gone to get the buses, but they're not allowing Black people basically on the buses. They're prioritizing Ukrainians. That's what they say. One African student who reached the Ukraine-Poland border wrote on Twitter that Ukrainian police and army were refusing to let Africans cross. Watch how they are threatening to shoot us, they say. So let's watch this video. So there's someone in there screaming, "We don't have bombs." Okay. So that's happening to Africans living in Ukraine. And that's important because I think it just demonstrates how we are being propagandized to believe that the Ukraine regime, the coup government, is some kind of quote-unquote civilized force. It's a democratic force. It's all of this. When in fact, it is nothing but a puppet government. It's nothing but a reflection of the very imperialist and racist global system led by the United States. It is a vassal state. And the way it has behaved towards Eastern Ukrainians, the people of Donbass, of Donetsk, of Lugansk, demonstrates that in just one instance. But there's just so many more examples from what I said about the Azov Battalion, that the Ukraine National Guard literally sharing a Twitter post from the Azov Battalion of calling Chechen, a Chechen organization, orcs, and using pig lard to grease their bullets that they're going to use against a majority Islam practicing people. I mean, this is what the Ukraine regime is. It's a puppet government. We should not be aligning with that. But this hashtag stand with Ukraine, hashtag save Ukraine, all of these hashtags only serve to propagandize us further into actual war. So Russia's military operation, call it what you want. I am awaiting evidence of mass civilian casualties and the complete and utter destruction of actual public infrastructure and institutions, which is characteristic of an actual invasion, right? NATO bombed Libya's water facilities. Schools, religious institutions in Syria have been bombed by NATO. U.S. drones have bombed weddings all across Afghanistan, Pakistan, Yemen. That is a war crime. That is a literal war crime. That is what imperialism is all about. We have not seen those reports coming out of Ukraine. So until I see that, I am reserving my judgment in that way to make this false equivalency, because I don't think that equivalency actually exists. And I'm going to share with you something positive that has come out of this military operation, right? Which I do not claim to be 100% in support of. I think that Russia does have real true reasons to conduct this operation. And I believe that context has to continuously be discussed and be part of the conversation, right? This larger problem of NATO aggression, this larger problem of the US meddling in the affairs of Russia, as well as the broader region, the broader Eurasian region, that has to be discussed as what actually lit the match and lit the fuse, not just merely Russian aggression, which unfortunately a lot of the left has adopted. So while you're here, while I'm sharing, please like the stream. Please hit the notifications bell. Please subscribe before you do that, because then you have to subscribe first. Subscribe button, then notifications bell. And also consider supporting my work at patreon.com/DannyHaiFong. For any monthly amount, you will help sustain this journalism. So our good friend Brian Berletic shared a video that we're going to watch about how Russia's military operation has actually done some good, especially for the people of Crimea, and the ways in which the Ukraine government was cutting off water resources. So Russia ends another of Ukraine's war crimes. Fresh water flows again to Crimea. So let's listen to this as the last thing I share for this stream before some closing comments.
Egregious crime through its military. The Western media would have you believe that Russia is committing some sort of egregious crime through its military intervention in neighboring Ukraine. But as a matter of fact, Russia is putting an end to several very serious and ongoing crimes committed by the regime in Kiev, installed into power by the U.S. in 2014. Crimes that began in 2014 and have only just ended because of Russia's military intervention. First and foremost was Kiev's relentless war against the Donbas region in eastern Ukraine. This left 14,000 dead on both sides, including over 3,000 civilians. This crime has been brought to an end by Russia's military intervention. There's another crime you might not have heard about because the West deliberately covered it up. It was the Ukrainian government deliberately cutting the Crimean Peninsula off from its source of fresh drinking water. 85 to 90% of Crimea's water came to it through the North Crimean Canal. This was dammed by the regime in Kiev since 2014, and it has since denied the 2.4 million inhabitants of the Crimean Peninsula fresh, safe drinking water, as well as water for agriculture. This is a crime against humanity. The Western media covered it up, but they would at certain times admit it, but just to brag about how much trouble is creating for Russia. Like this Bloomberg article right here, Crimea's water crisis is an impossible problem for Putin. Well, I guess not, because this is the Russian military blowing that dam up and once again allowing fresh water to flow to the 2.4 million inhabitants of the Crimean Peninsula. This is another crime against humanity carried out by the Western-backed regime in Kiev that Russia's military intervention has brought to an end, and one you will not hear mentioned in the Western media as they continue trying to bolster support for a government that has done so much damage to its own people and to its neighbor.
All right. So there you have it. Brian Berletic says it straight. Sets us all straight. Ukraine was cutting off essential resources like water from eastern Ukraine to starve the people into submission at the behest of the United States, at the behest of NATO and Europe. That's what it was doing. And now that has in some ways come to an end. Some are saying that they hear an echo. Sorry about that. Do you hear an echo now? Hold on one sec. Okay, I don't know if you're hearing an echo. I can't hear myself. I don't have headphones on or nothing like that. So there should not be an echo anymore. I ended the screen share. So that's it. Okay. I don't know. Okay, it was the video. Sorry about that. Okay, let's just move on. All right, I have about 10 to 15 more minutes to share with you all. So just some closing remarks about what we learned today. And while you're listening, please drop a like. Please boost the stream in that way. Please subscribe to the channel. Please hit the notifications bell. And of course, the way you support my work is not through, you know, anything except patreon.com/DannyHaiFong. You know, I'm trying to keep this ad free, etc. So, to conclude, what we are witnessing is a massive psyop, a political act of manipulation by the forces of empire to get us to support Ukraine's coup government, similar to how in 2014, the United States and its NATO allies worked overtime through direct support and through a propaganda war to get us to support the Maidan Revolution, quote unquote, the color revolution, also known as a revolution of dignity, that overthrew the democratically elected government of Viktor Yanukovych. That is the point here. And until we get evidence of Russia's massive wrongdoing in this military operation to Ukrainian people, ordinary Ukrainians, right? And I don't doubt that there might be some unfortunate incidents that occur from this, right? Especially given that the Ukraine paramilitary groups, the Ukrainian military, its installations are embedded with the people. I mean, this is part of the strategy that a lot of puppet governments take, especially underdeveloped countries where they have a heavy countryside that does not support advanced infrastructure. They have to be located in the cities. This is part of political economy and understanding how underdevelopment, understanding how imperialism impacts countries like Ukraine and creates pretty devastating conditions such as these, where somewhere like Kiev is so heavily concentrated in terms of all of the capital that exists in the country and thus is the only place that maybe that can support heavy military hardware and installations. That's just how it is in countries like this. While in the imperialist orbit, the West likes to use its advantages economically to actually hide its military from the people in a lot of ways. It does its best to enforce a heavy securitized regime while at the same time concealing what that securitized regime is doing to ordinary people in the United States and the West. That is why most of the military bases in the United States, they're not technically in places where you would expect to see a lot of activity from ordinary people going on as well, whether you go to New Mexico or Texas or even Massachusetts, where I'm from. They are tucked away. And now we live in an era, of course, of militarized police. So a lot of the militarization has come to the fore for heavily populated areas as well. So this is where we're at, guys. We have to see how these negotiations go. I, for one, despite all of people's pessimism about this moment, you know, and there have been concerning developments, right? The more that the U.S. and NATO continue to aggressively respond to Russia's military operation, the more that things like Russia putting its defense forces in charge of its nuclear arms on alert, right? That's going to happen more and more as things like this happen more and more. And we have to expect in a new Cold War scenario where the United States is provoking and instigating these kind of crises that something like this can happen. Now, I wasn't expecting Russia to do this necessarily. I thought that the United States would just continue to escalate its sanctions regime, militarization, all of that, but that Russia would broker through its independence declaration of recognizing the independence of the breakaway republics, would broker some kind of policy that would be sustainable for itself and those that they support, right? The LDR and the DPR. The LPR and the DPR, the two breaker republics. But we don't have a crystal ball. We can't predict everything. So a lot of us were incorrect in some respects. But now that as we look at it with a sober lens, look at what's happened, it's quite clear that every other solution was exhausted, right? And we have to promote that understanding that Russia, from the beginning of these rumors, 3+ months ago, Russia's going to invade. Russia's going to invade. Okay, we're going to send, right? What did the United States do? We're going to send 100 millions more in military aid, lethal aid. We're going to continue to send these weapons, and Ukraine is actually going to escalate, which happened. More than 100,000 troops went to the eastern Ukraine to escalate the war on Donetsk and Lugansk and Donbass in general. Russia, since the beginning, was saying demilitarize, stop it. That's all we want. Do not admit NATO into Ukraine, demilitarize the situation, and we can go on in the same way that things have been going on before the intervention, before the escalation. And what did the United States do? Well, Joe Biden in January basically gave the middle finger to Vladimir Putin, said, nope, we're not negotiating anything. And then after that, there wasn't even any consideration for Russia's requests or demands, so to speak. So that in and of itself shows how shallow people are to jump on the anti-Russia bandwagon, to jump on the new Cold War bandwagon and say, this is Russia's fault and there's nothing that it can explain its actions. It's its fault alone. That is shallow analysis. That is decontextualizing the situation. That only serves imperialism.
In 1907, this is what Woodrow Wilson said. 1907, this was, I don't even think he was yet governor of New Jersey. Well, he certainly wasn't president. Maybe he was governor. He was a political science professor and president of Princeton for a while, and then governor of New Jersey, and then president of the United States. In 1907, Woodrow Wilson noted the role that's played by the capitalist state on behalf of private capital. I quote him, "Since trade ignores national boundaries and the manufacturer insists on having the world as a market, the flag of his nation must follow him, and the doors of the nations which are closed against him must be battered down. Concessions obtained by financiers must be safeguarded by ministers of state." Now, you hear that? That's a bourgeois college professor, president of the United States. If I just read that statement, if I said the financiers are serviced by the ministers of state, the ministers of state have to safeguard the financiers. You know what people would say? Oh, you're Marxist. Oh, you're Marx. That's Marxist, you know. I hear that. I used to hear that all the time. When I was just getting myself radicalized, I used to hear that. I'd say things like, I think racism is actually, you say it's a failure of capitalism. I think it's a success of capitalism because it's used to divide the working class. It's used to suppress wages. And my colleagues would say, that's Marx. That's Marx. I said, Marx? I thought that was Parenti. I look in the mirror. I'd say things like, you know, I don't think the police are neutral. I think why in a strike they side with the factory owners and not the workers? Why are they there defending the property and not the right of the worker who has an entitlement in the labor that he invests? And I say, well, that's Marx. That's Marx. I would hear this all the time. I say, you know, I don't think U.S. policy is so innocent. We're out there helping the finance. Oh, that's Marx, they'd say all the time. And I say, boy, this guy Marx was really something. You know, here I am. I'm knocking myself out trying to make an analysis. Every time I come up with something, they give him the credit. So, that's pretty good. And then I realize something. That wasn't Marx. That wasn't Parenti. That was reality. That's what it was. And reality happens to be Marxist. So let's repeat that sentence and go on. Woodrow Wilson is talking. Concessions obtained by financiers must be safeguarded by ministers of state, even if the sovereignty of unwilling nations be outraged in the process. Colonies must be obtained or planted in order that no useful corner of the world may be overlooked or left unused. Now, that does sound like Marx, the manifesto. The same wording, he says, capitalism goes into every corner of the world to recreate it in its own image and put it to use for its capital accumulation process. Interesting. Sometimes the flag will go in before the dollars get there, and that's to create new opportunities. For instance, in 1919, in Haiti, the people started a popular rebellion and revolution. They actually built a popular militia to try to get the land back from the landowners, to try to get the big companies out of there and all that. The U.S. declared political instability. They have certain code words, you know, they use. Political instability, undemocratic forces, we got to defend it. Political instability, and of course, racism gets used very handily here. You say, well, these little brown people in this little island have to learn self-governance. See, we will have to go down and show them and at least bring law and order and stability back. So they went down just to take care of that. And they stayed a mere 19 years. And they killed 18,000 Haitians. And they also kicked out the French, German, and British companies, and U.S. companies came in. You see, capitalism not only fights the class war against its own laboring class, capital formations will often fight against each other and against other national capital formations. And, of course, the people pick up the tab on that, too. Yugoslavia is a great case in point. I have a book there called To Kill a Nation. Got any more copies of it? Good. See, here comes the infomercial now. We start. There it is. Okay. Yugoslavia was tolerated for quite some time as a breakaway country from the Eastern Bloc of Nations, so-called Bloc of Nations. But after 1990, the U.S. saw no reason to tolerate its existence anymore. I mean, here was a country, a rather large country right in Central Europe, which was not going the way of free market reforms as was happening in Russia, the Ukraine, Poland, and all over. They were not doing that usual thing. They were not, at first they weren't. Yugoslavia had an economy that was 80% state-owned still. Yugoslavia had a high standard of living and a high degree of economic equality. Anybody could go to school to the highest level they want, and medical care was free. Yugoslavia showed no interest in joining the European Union, no interest at all in joining NATO. It had a productive industrial base, a successful auto industry. 80% of the Yugoslav auto market was sold by the Yugo. It had construction firms that competed quite successfully and throughout, even in Western Europe. Now, when you destroy all that, you, of course, increase the value of your own capital. If I destroy your firms, I destroy your auto industry, I increase the value of my auto industry. If I destroy your agricultural base, I increase the value and open market opportunities for my agricultural base. And that's exactly what happened. German and U.S. agencies supported every retrograde secessionist and reactionary ethnic nationalist in Bosnia, in Croatia, and in Kosovo. And today, Yugoslavia has been broken up into a cluster of little right-wing republics where everything is privatized, everything's been deregulated, sold off to private investors at garage sale prices. That's the public capital of the people's labor is now given away to private investors, where the media have been taken over by rich private investors or conservatives. Pension funds have been plundered and disappeared. Public services have been shredded. I was just in Belgrade last March, and I was with a friend, and she said, well, I'm going to meet you later. It was a Saturday. Now, I'm going to meet you later, but I'm going to a doctor's appointment. I said, what do you mean? It's 7 o'clock Saturday night. You're going to see a doctor? Who sees a doctor at 7 o'clock? She says, oh, here in Yugoslavia, the doctors will see you anytime you want because they're so desperate for patients. The public health services are broken down, so people are literally without, unless you can pay, are literally without services. And 7 was a convenient time for her. And the doctor said, okay, sure. There's inflation in Yugoslavia now. There's unemployment, poverty, suicide, prostitution. All of this has skyrocketed, and we hear next to nothing about it in the press. It's a free market paradise. It has been brought into the fold of the West. That's Yugoslavia today. And unfortunately, there were too many people on the left who supported that war and swallowed the official line, they swallowed the mass media line right down their throats. They thought they were fighting rape, they thought they were fighting a demon called Milosevic, and they didn't, and they were just ill-informed and taken in. It's much too bad. And I'm including some very notable progressive speakers who swallowed that line, including one who calls himself a pacifist.
When the generator's on, to the